From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the Middle East conflict from the point of view of Palestinian and Israeli children. We talk with filmmakers Beezy Goldberg and Justine Shapiro about their documentary, Promises. Also, we talk with Noelle Howie. When she was a teenager dealing with her female identity, her father was dealing with his. He was cross-dressing and preparing for a sex change operation. Howie has written a new memoir called Dress Codes. And book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews The Dive from Clausen's Pier, the debut novel by Ann Packer. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Police have confirmed that a body found in Washington's Rock Creek Park is that of Chandra Levy, a 24-year-old intern who disappeared more than a year ago. Police officials based their determination on dental records. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
Washington, D.C. Police Chief Charles Ramsey says a man out walking his dog found the skeletal remains in what Chief Ramsey called an inaccessible area of the heavily wooded park. There were bits of clothing and other items that led police to believe the body was in fact Levy's, which the medical examiner later confirmed. Chief Ramsey said the medical examiner had not yet determined the manner or cause of death, nor could he say if Levy died there or if the body was moved to the site where it was eventually discovered. Levy had been employed in the office of Congressman Gary Condit, with whom it was reported she had an affair. She was last seen April 30, 2001. Condit was questioned by police, but never said to be a suspect in Levy's disappearance. Brian Naylor, NPR News, Washington.
A jury in Birmingham, Alabama, has convicted Bobby Frank Cherry of murder in the 1963 church bombing that killed four black girls. Cherry, a 71-year-old former Ku Klux Klansman, was the last of the suspects in the case to be tried. He faces an automatic sentence of life in prison. Prosecutors said Cherry and other Klan members conspired to bomb the 16th Street Baptist Church, a gathering place for protests against racial segregation. Police questioned Cherry about the bombing shortly after it happened, but he wasn't charged until 1995, when family members said Cherry had boasted about his involvement in the crime. The White House says it's perplexed by the subpoena it received today from the Senate Governmental Affairs Committee. The subpoena is seeking information about administration contacts with Enron executives before the corporation collapsed. NPR's Pam Fessler reports.
The subpoena, approved on a party-line vote, is the first one to be issued by Congress in its growing dispute with the Bush White House over the sharing of information. The Senate panel, headed by Connecticut Democrat Joseph Lieberman, is seeking details about White House contacts with Enron officials last year. White House spokeswoman Ann Womack called the subpoena premature and said, quote, "We're perplexed as to why the senator chose to pursue this confrontational approach." Womack said the White House told Lieberman it was planning as early as today to provide him with details about staff contacts with officials of the Houston-based company. But Lieberman says the message he got was that he would not be receiving the information he's looking for. Pam Fessler, NPR News, Washington.
In stocks today, the Dow Industrials gained 52 points to close at 10,157 in active trading of more than 1.1 billion shares. The Nasdaq Composite Index gained 9 points. It closed at 1,673. The S&P 500 gained 6 points. This is NPR News. The Senate has cleared the way for a final vote on a bill that would give President Bush more authority to negotiate trade deals. The measure would allow the president to make trade agreements with other countries that Congress could either reject or accept, but not change. The bill would also renew trade benefits for four South American trade partners, Bolivia, Colombia, Ecuador, and Peru. The bill, as it now stands, is a compromise between Republicans who want free trade and Democrats who want job protection for American workers. Police in London say they've recovered millions of dollars linked to a recent robbery at the city's main airport. The robbery highlighted security failures at the airport. Alistair Wanklin reports from London.
British police say the cash they seized nearly matches the $3.2 million stolen in March from a transit area at London's Heathrow Airport. The bills of unspecified currency were found in buildings raided this week in the British capital. 12 men and women were also arrested. Heathrow Airport has been the site of two big cash heists this year. In both instances, boxes of banknotes in transit were seized from supposedly secure areas. The thieves apparently had free access to the airside, with security passes and knowledge of checkpoints. The two heists prompted criticism of British airport security measures, especially in the context of September the 11th. For NPR News, I'm Alistair Wanklin in London.
As President Bush visited Germany today, police clashed with pro-Palestinian demonstrators in Berlin. The violence broke out in the midst of a peaceful demonstration by about 20,000 people who oppose any expansion of the war on terrorism. The clash took place as President Bush met with German Chancellor Gerhard Schröder about a half mile away. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, maker of cholesterol-free vegetable oil, ADM, the nature of what's to come, on the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. In the documentary film Promises, we meet four Israeli and three Palestinian children, and we see the Middle East crisis through their eyes. In a New York Times review, Julie Salomon wrote, "The film illustrates the uneasy convergence of history and modernity, fanaticism and reasonableness." The movie was shown on the PBS series POV and is now screening in many theaters around the country. My guests are two of the film's directors, Justine Shapiro, and BZ Goldberg, who was born in America but lived in Israel from the age of 7 until his 20s. He's often on camera talking with the children. The children were chosen to represent a cross-section of the Middle East. Yarko and Danielle are twins who are secular Israelis. Shlomo is an ultra-Orthodox Jew, and Moishi is a right-wing Jewish settler. Mahmoud lives in the Muslim quarter of Jerusalem and is a supporter of Hamas. Sanabel and Faraj are Palestinian refugees living in a refugee camp. During the course of the film, the Israeli twins and the two Palestinian refugees meet at the camp. The film was shot between 1997 and 2000 during a comparatively peaceful time, but the filmmakers have remained in touch with most of the children during the current upheaval. Justine Shapiro says that they focused on children ages 9 to 13 for a reason.
We saw kids doing what adults and politicians never do. I mean, for example, one of the boys in the film, Faraj, a Palestinian boy, he's adamantly against meeting the Israelis. But after being somewhat cajoled and convinced by Sanabel, another Palestinian refugee, and after seeing Polaroid photographs of the two Israeli twins, Faraj changes his mind. And this is a really big thing. It's so rare that we see politicians change their mind and say, you know what, I'm going to try this. I said I wasn't, but I am going to try this. And Faraj, you know, in the middle of a conversation with him, surprised us and asked us for the phone number of the twins and called them up and invites them to the camp. You know, the children are sponges of their environments, but they're also still malleable. They're still at that age where curiosity, in a way, is even a stronger force than the rhetoric and the dogma that they grow up with.
BC, I want to ask you about one of the moments in the film where you're on camera talking to one of the Palestinian kids, and you're obviously really close. You could just see the chemistry on screen, and he's kind of leaning his elbow on your knee. And he's explaining that he really hates all Israelis, and when he sees an Israeli, or maybe he says when he sees a Jew, he wants to throw a rock at them. Then you explain to him something that he apparently doesn't know, which is that you're part Israeli, you lived in Israel a lot of your life, and you're Jewish. Describe what happens when he hears that from you.
Well, I was sitting with Mahmoud, who is an avid supporter of Hamas and Hezbollah. And to most Israeli kids, Palestinian means rock thrower, terrorist, at best construction worker or busboy. To Palestinian kids, Jew means Israeli, means soldier, oppressor, settler, occupier, full stop, that's it. So I'm sitting there with Mahmoud. The funny thing was, it was actually the third time we'd had this conversation. He was just in such deep denial. He couldn't accept the possibility that I was Jewish, because a Jewish person to him is someone who occupies his land and oppresses him. And he wouldn't accept it. He said, "You're not an authentic Jew. You're one of those American Jews. You're not a real Jew." And I kept insisting, "No, I actually am an authentic Jew. And I grew up here. My family is here." And he wouldn't accept it. You know, he just would not. I mean, he's sitting there telling me how he wants to kill Jews, how he wants to basically, you know, help create suicide bombs and blow up as many Jews as possible so that there'll be fewer, but won't accept the fact that I'm that I am actually a real authentic Jew, Yehudi Asli, as they say in Arabic. And funny thing was, even after that conversation, 2 years later, I stood in his father's coffee store in the Old City, and he said, "You know, I've been meaning to ask you a question. Are you a Christian or a Muslim?" And his little brother stood from the side trying to mouth the words, Jew, he's an American Jew. And it took years for Mahmoud to realize. It was actually not till Mahmoud sat in a theater in West Jerusalem, he was one of four Arabs in an audience of about 400 Israelis, and watched the film and then saw a question and answer session. And afterwards, he came up and he said, "Now that I've seen you do a question and answer thing in Hebrew, I realize you must be an authentic Jew."
Well, how did it affect your feelings about him? I mean, you're trying to get really close to these kids, and it sounds like you really succeeded. But here's this kid who, I mean, clearly he's making an exception by having a relationship with you. I mean, he really thinks he hates all Jews. Is it easy to be friendly to like a kid who has that attitude?
I think that the conflict really isn't Jewish-Palestinian. It's really a conflict between Palestinians and Israelis.
Yeah, definitely. It just to add to this complexity that gets created, Palestinians refer to Israelis as Jews. They don't actually mean the people in the United States. It's just something that's kind of become part of the vernacular. When we did this interview with Mahmoud, I mean, the truth was I wanted to choke him. I actually had to sit on my hands because they kept moving towards his throat, because he talks about, you know, we need to kill as many Jews as possible. And I would say, "Mahmoud, listen, you know, when those buses blow up, sometimes there are Palestinians on the buses too." And every time I said anything, he had something from the Quran to back up his position. He said, "Oh no, the Palestinians go directly to heaven, but the Jews go directly to hell," which, you know, made me again want to choke him. Yet Justine and I and Carlos had decided really, really early on in the process of making the film that the governing principle behind this film could not possibly be justice. That some idea of ours, some artificial idea of what justice is, was not going to work in making this film, because then we would just come out with some kind of biased to one side or another propaganda film. We decided that awareness and curiosity were much more important to us. So therefore, when Mahmoud talked about killing as many Jews as possible, we would ask him questions like, "Well, how? You know, what kinds of explosives will you use? And do you pack nails in with them? Or how would you do that?" To try and get deep under the surface and understand. So this was one case. This was the case where I had to exercise the most restraint. And it wasn't so much because of his views, because we had heard these kinds of views from a lot of kids. It was really because so much of Mahmoud's point of view was coming from a place of dogma. No, the kids in the refugee camp, they really have a lot of day-to-day experience. And also there was openness when we spoke to them. They were willing to consider talking to Israeli kids. They were willing to consider that killing Israelis might not be a good idea. With Mahmoud, every line that came out of him was Quranic verse, and it was all kind of, it was so dogmatic that there was nowhere to go with conversation. So in that case, I really had to restrain myself and sort of, you know, go hit the wall when we left the house.
And I should say, some distortion of Quranic verse.
Yeah, definitely.
So you started working on the film in 95. Mm-hmm. Most of the taping in the movie was done in 97 and 98.
Right.
And then 2 years later, you contacted the children again. That was in the year 2000.
Mm-hmm.
And you've been in touch with some of them since 2000. What are some of the most dramatic ways in which some of the children have changed since you first met them?
Well, the really amazing experience was recently being with Sana Bel, the Palestinian refugee from the Haisha refugee camp, and Yarko and Danielle, the Israeli twins, when they came out to Los Angeles in March. And
this was for the Academy Awards.
For the Academy Awards. And it was really interesting to see Sana Bel change over the years. When we met her in 1997, her father had been held in prison for 2 years in administrative detention without trial. Sana Bel hadn't seen her father for those 2 years, and for pretty much half of her life he'd been in and out of prison. He's a journalist with the PFLP. But even at that time, she was so curious and so open to the idea of meeting these Israelis and being with us and sharing, really sharing her thoughts and her feelings, and she really defied my own stereotype of the, you know, Palestinian Muslim girl. I mean, she's growing up in a family where, you know, discussion and communication is really important. And but then when the recent Intifada started in September of 2000, Sanaa Bell started to feel really isolated because in her mind, all Israelis were against the Palestinian people. And she didn't have contact with any Israelis. And she became very angry. And like many, many kids living in the refugee camps, she felt that, you know, suicide bombings were, you know, a viable solution and justified it, you know, as a measure of hopelessness. Well, when we told her that we were nominated for an Academy Award, we wanted to know if she'd be willing to come out and if she'd be willing to be with Yarko and Danielle. And our idea was that if we were to win, we wanted Sanaa Bell and one of the Israeli twins to go on stage and accept the award and say something, you know, from their heart and hopefully for peace. And Sanaa Bell said, well, I'll come to the Academy Awards, but I'm not going to stand on stage with an Israeli. Well, they met in the Amsterdam airport, and it was a very long flight. And during the course of the flight, they played sort of musical chairs, and they ended up sitting next to each other, and they ended up connecting with each other. And when the flight was delayed in Dallas, Delta didn't give anybody hotel rooms. They were all made to sleep on the lounge in the Dallas airport, and they created what they called the first Palestinian-Israeli refugee camp. And all the, you know, the two Palestinian, because Sanaa Bell came with a Palestinian girlfriend, the two Palestinian girls, Yarko and Danielle, the two Israeli boys, and their mother were all asleep there and hanging out in this, you know, Palestinian-Israeli refugee camp, as they called it. And then they spent this week together in Los Angeles, and Sanaa Bell really changed. She felt so supported by Yarko and Danielle, and she started to talk about peace and very future thinking and positive and hopeful. And it was a real transformation, and what I saw in that was that as long as she felt isolated, she became more angry and hopeless. But when she felt connected, she, you know, felt more hopeful. And now they're in regular email contact with Yarko and Danielle.
There was, you know, Sanaa Bell had no idea, she told us. She said, I didn't know that there were any Israelis who would stand by my side. I thought that the entire Israeli population was behind Sharon. I didn't think that anybody would support me. And the twins, on the other hand, had absolutely no idea what Sanaa Bell's life was like. On a day-to-day basis. And so, you know, they really had to tackle some really serious issues while we were together in Los Angeles. There were moments where they said, okay, all the grown-ups out of the room, we need to talk for a while. And they would talk about things like the Palestinian right of return, like the settlements, like the nature of a Palestinian state, like Israeli security. They really wanted to get down and dirty and try and understand what the other side felt and to think about what possible solutions were. And their lives have been changed by this in a very dramatic way, in that they are both have gone back to their to their communities. Actually, the girls just went back yesterday. They'd been stranded here because they couldn't get in. Israel wasn't letting Palestinians in over the Jordanian bridge, but they just went back, and they're going to have to stand up in their communities and say, you know, there actually are Israelis who are who can support us and with whom it's worth having a meaningful conversation. I know that the boys, the twins, are having a hard time with their friends because a lot of people are so anti-Palestinian. And Yarko and Danielle are standing up and saying, you know, they're not all horrible. They actually want coexistence. What they want is very, very simple. And I think that Sanaa Bell and Kian, her friend who traveled here with her, are going to have even a harder time because they've actually been shunned a little bit by, you know, they've gotten some emails saying that they're betraying the Palestinian cause because they're meeting with Israelis outside of the country, and nobody should meet with Israelis because that puts out some kind of message of normalization, as if everything is cool. There's this idea in the Palestinian community that Israelis and Palestinians should not meet because that portrays the situation as solved. And, you know, I asked Sanaa Bell a couple of days ago if she would be interested in going, if she could get across the checkpoint, if she would be interested in going to a peace rally, because there have been these big peace demonstrations in Tel Aviv with the twins. And she said She said, I would die to go. I would love to go to a peace rally, and I couldn't possibly do it because the community. What will people say when I come back if someone finds out that I went to Israel, that I was at a demonstration with two Israeli boys? It would just be horrible for me.
Do you know if any of the Israeli kids had friends who were killed in the recent suicide bombings, or if any of the Palestinian kids had friends from the neighborhood who were among the suicide bombers?
As far as I know, none of the Israeli kids have immediate friends who were killed recently. Moshe does have a friend who was killed, back in 97, the end of 97. Although his settlement has been fired on repeatedly by the local, Palestinian villages. But the Palestinian kids in the refugee camp do have some friends who were killed. There was a young boy who was killed there in November who was of Sanabel's age. Mm-hmm. And more recently, a girl who was a few years older than Sanabel and lived, a few minutes away from her house, was the girl who killed herself in Jerusalem, the first teenager who was a suicide bomber.
My guests are Justine Shapiro and Beezy Goldberg, directors of the documentary Promises. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guests are Beezy Goldberg and Justine Shapiro. They're co-directors of the new movie Promises. And it's a documentary about the conflict in the Middle East as seen through the eyes of Palestinian and Israeli children from the ages of about 9 to 14. Beezy, I know during the Intifada you were, during the first Intifada, you were an Israeli journalist covering the Intifada. So a lot of your experiences then with Palestinian children were probably watching them throw rocks. Was it easy to get to know any individuals when you were covering the Intifada? Did you have a sense of who the people were who were throwing rocks and what their motivation was? I mean, do you see the children differently now as a filmmaker than you did as a journalist during the Intifada?
Well, during the Intifada, I worked mostly as a sound man for foreign networks. I was I worked a lot for CNN and for NBC and for Reuters. I didn't do that much work for the Israeli media. And we didn't get to know people. In fact, the longest amount of time I got to spend with any one person was 15, 20 minutes or a half an hour interview. And the closest I got to kids who were throwing rocks were the kids who were throwing rocks at me. Mm-hmm. So this was the first time that we were able to really meet kids and on both sides, actually, because I had also never made personal relationships with settlers, for example. I came from a community in Israel. People thought I was nuts when I was going to the refugee camp. People would say, you're going to the refugee camp? What did you lose there? But they really thought I was crazy for going to the settlement. The settlers are considered by kind of my social set in Israel to be lunatics, to be crazy. So I didn't know any settlers. For Justine and Carlos and I, it was such an incredibly enriching experience that we could meet people on all sides of this very, very complicated conflict and really get to know them and get to kind of, feel what their life feels like and see what their houses are like and see in what ways they're really similar to each other and the music that they listen to and the ways in which they're so, so utterly different.
The Israeli twins who we've talked about, there's a part in the movie where they explain that they really don't want to go in the military, they don't want to have to kill people. You even have them talking to a wounded Israeli soldier who says, well, sometimes you have to fight. Those twins are closer to military age now. How do they feel about having to go into the military soon?
Both Yarko and Daniel are avid volleyball players, and their dream is to be national volleyball stars, in which they'll have to do some kind of quick form of basic training and not spend that much time in the army. And they have said that they don't want to serve, they would rather not serve in combat units because they don't want to have to end up serving in the occupied territories. Daniel is not 100% sure, and Yarko felt that for sure. He, in fact, said, if I was, forced to serve in the territories or fire at a refugee camp, I would prefer to run away and risk being in jail.
How soon do they actually face this decision?
Just under a year and a half. Right now, what they told me is that the thing that's standing between them and kind of being volleyball stars is they have to grow 3 inches. So they're trying to eat all the foods that they've been told will make them grow faster.
BZ, what about you? Your family has lived both in the United States and in Israel. Do you debate what Israel's political position should be in the conflict a lot in your family?
Most of the debate I have actually is with my immediate family in Israel. And, like any good Israelis, we debate just about anything and everything having to do with politics. And my family is living in Israel. And the truth is that their concern, their day-to-day concern, is much more focused on issues of security and their own feelings of safety. So, yes, I have had definitely conversations and people who are friends and family who have asked, well, why are you doing this? Really, do the people outside of Israel really need to know all this? It's not going to be good for Israel. And also sometimes people, come up with these ideas, for example, that the reason Palestinians hate Israelis is because they're being educated that way in school. And having been there and having been to the schools, I know that that's the case in some of the schools, but in some of the schools, that's really not the case. And sadly, in the last 20 months or so, it's the Israelis who are educating the Palestinians towards hatred, in my estimation. So, yeah, I do end up having arguments and fights, and a lot of the time it's actually easier not to speak politics because positions are so firm. An Israeli novelist once said it's actually easier in Israel to change your gender than to change your political point of view.
BZ Goldberg and Justine Shapiro directed the documentary Promises. It's currently playing in theaters in several cities and will open in more cities in the weeks to come. We'll talk more in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. And from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, by the state of Vermont, connecting summer travelers with the mountains, lakes, and historic villages of rural Vermont. Online travel planning at vermontvacation.com. And Anchor Books, publishers of the new paperback Ghost Soldiers, the epic account of World War II's greatest rescue mission by Hampton Sides. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, finding out that your father cross-dresses and wants to be a woman. We talk with Noel Howey about her new memoir, Dress Codes. Also, Maureen Corrigan reviews The Dive from Clausen's Pier, the debut novel by Ann Packer. And we continue our interview with filmmakers BZ Goldberg and Justine Shapiro.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Beezy Goldberg and Justine Shapiro, two of the directors of the documentary Promises, a film that looks at the Middle East crisis through the eyes of Palestinian and Israeli children. Your film is so much about how children's politics in the Middle East are shaped and how their views of Israelis and Palestinians are shaped. Beezy, you grew up in Israel from the age of 7 through your 20s. Did you have any friends as a child who were Palestinian?
No, I didn't. And, you know, most Israeli children don't. I grew up in this pretty liberal, progressive family. And at the same time, there was this background message from the community of, went sort of like this, there are good Arabs and there are bad Arabs. The good Arabs are dead Arabs. So I didn't have any Palestinian friends when I was growing up.
And did you have any friends who were killed by Palestinians when you were growing up?
I did. When I was 14, the kid I sat next to in school, a kid named Imri, was killed in an incident on Israel's coastal road. There was an attack there. And you know, I remember the day after he was killed being at school with a group of my friends and trying to figure out. We got together at recess. The teachers actually insisted that we continue studying as normal. But at recess, we got together and tried to figure out what we could do, as if there's something that we could do. And I remembered we decided that the only thing we could do is to take revenge. And the janitor in the school had a son who was mentally handicapped, and we decided that he would be, you know, fair game, that we could kill this kid, and that would feel good, that the feeling of revenge would make us feel a little bit more peace. And then, I mean, we were 14 years old, and the bell rang, and we had to go in from recess, and we didn't get around to it. But I remember that feeling. That actually is one of the things that has helped me understand some of the kind of seemingly illogical rage that comes when people have lost friends and family on both sides of the conflict.
Did you think at that time that you would be capable of being one of the killers seeking revenge?
Oh, totally. I mean, we were sitting there together, and all of us were sort of planning how we were going to kill this kid. There were other moments, you know, when I was working in the West Bank. There was one time where a rock went through my front window and hit me in the eye, and I remember feeling such murderous rage for a moment that I know that if the kid was in front of me who did this and I had a gun, I feel like I would have killed him. I was feeling so angry, and feeling like that kind of revenge would make me feel good. But it's this, you know, momentary thing, and it goes away after a minute or two, and you know, what's useful about it for me is understanding how someone could feel so rageful and so vengeful, not condoning it, but really understanding how a human being could feel that way.
Have you screened the movie for Israelis and for Palestinians?
The film actually showed in Israel. It was in theaters for a few months in the three big cities in Israel, and it was at the film festival in Jerusalem. And was on television a couple months ago. Mm-hmm. The response from Israelis has been overwhelmingly warm. We originally made the film thinking about an American audience, a European audience, and tried to make it, you know, very accessible and basic in its approach to history and politics. But so many Israelis have said to us, you know, I really didn't know about this particular part of Palestinian lives. And people have said, you've really opened my mind. And I'm thinking about the conflict in a different way. The Palestinian Authority won't allow a film like this. Actually, none of the Arab states at this point would allow a film like this to be screened on TV or in theaters because of this issue of normalization. You know, in the film, Israelis and Palestinians meet, and this is considered not to be a ripe time for these kinds of meetings. So the film can't be screened officially. However, when the film screened on Israeli television, the Palestinians were able to see it on TV, and when the Academy Awards came around, the Palestinian community, nobody even knew what the Academy Awards were in the refugee camp. But we heard that thousands of families in the refugee camp stayed up in the middle of the night to see and watch and wait for the film to win, hoping to see Sanabel take the stage. The film is being circulated in the way that a lot of banned films get around in the Arab world, which is videotapes. People make copies of videotapes, and we're actually working right now on getting a good Arabic translation of the film so that we can make a high-quality master to make the best possible bootleg tapes to circulate in the Arab world. Mahmoud, the blonde-haired kid from Jerusalem, actually came to the screening I mentioned in the
This is the kid
film.
Who wants to join Hamas.
This is the kid who is supportive of Hamas. He actually said, "I am not part of Hamas, but right. I support them." He made that distinction. He came to the screening, and I was worried about him. I was worried that, here he is saying that he wants to kill Jews, and he's sitting in an audience of 400 Jews, and I was thinking, what's going to happen? Is someone going to get angry at him? And somehow, I felt that it was okay, and at the end of the screening, I said, I'd like to tell you that there's someone here from the film. Mahmoud has been, his political point of views and mine often don't agree, and oftentimes we get into fights, but I really admire his courage at speaking his mind, during times when not a lot of people were speaking their mind. And today I admire his courage because he's come here to West Jerusalem to sit in this theater with 400 Israelis. And I think that takes a lot of courage. And at that point, Mahmoud stood up and he got this rousing ovation. And Mahmoud came to me after the screening and said, I didn't know that there were Israelis like this. I thought all the Israelis were soldiers and settlers. I really didn't know that there were people who would appreciate me in this way. So, it affected him. And what we're hearing from the Palestinian community is a lot of support for the film. In the refugee camp, some people have spoken out against Sanavel and Faraj, the two refugee kids in the film, and said they're traitors because they met with Israeli kids. But most of what we've gotten is very, very positive. The Palestinians feel like the film is, they say, well, it's a good film, but it's a little pro-Israeli. And the Israelis have said, well, this is a good film, but it's a little pro-Palestinian. So we feel like we must have done something right.
What about the children themselves? What do they think of your movie?
They all can't understand why they're not in it more. I mean, we shot close to 200 hours of footage, so you can imagine how much we ended up editing.
Well, I want to thank you both so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Thank you, Terry.
Justine Shapiro and B.Z. Goldberg directed the documentary Promises, along with Carlos Bellotto. It's continuing to open in theaters around the country. Promises is also available for educational distribution. Coming up, what it's like when Dad wants to be a woman. This is Fresh Air. When Noel Howie was a teenager trying to figure out what it means to be a woman, her father was going through a similar transition. He wanted to be a woman. Noel Howie was 17 when she learned her father was a cross-dresser. A few years later, he had a sex change operation and has subsequently identified as a lesbian. In the new memoir, Dress Codes, Howie writes about the mind-bending gender questions her father's predicament raised for her. Let's start with a reading from the book.
I have a dad who is a woman much like me, but with better legs. And when he was still male, I had a dad possibly like yours. Sullen, sporadically hostile, frequently vacant. I had a dad who became a woman in order to be nice. I have a family that survived a life in the closet by employing humor, tinted car windows, and thousands of dollars worth of therapy. A family that gave its patriarch Chanel No. 5 for Father's Day. A traditional family. Loving father, supportive mother, doting child, that would probably be the right wing's worst nightmare. I am a different person because my father was a man, then a girl, then a woman. I watched her go through puberty right after I did, putting on too much makeup before going for the natural look, wearing 3-inch heels before deciding that flats had better arch support.
Noelle, you write in your memoir that your father became a woman in order to be nice. How did his personality compare when he was a man to when he became a she?
When my father was a man, we liked to call him an aspiring alcoholic. He wasn't all that successful because he was able to quit drinking rather quickly and easily. But He was very cold, very abrupt, very neglectful of both me and my mother. I mean, I don't like to make it sound too woe is me or, you know, too tragic, because it wasn't really terrible. I mean, my father sort of behaved in the way that many fathers of his generation behaved, which is somewhat cold and somewhat abrupt. But he was so removed from my childhood when I was growing up, and what was very different when he came out and started the transformation of becoming a woman is he really started being a part of my life. She started asking questions about my life. She started trying to make up for all these years where she had sort of held me at arm's length. And I don't really feel that I had a father until my father became a female.
How did your father first come out to your mother, you know, years before he actually got the transsexual surgery?
My father came out a number of times to my mother. The first time was when they were 16-year-old high school sweethearts and they were on the telephone. And my father suddenly blurted out that he liked to wear fuzzy sweaters, and meaning girl sweaters. And my mother didn't really know how to react to that, but she thought, fuzzy sweaters, what's wrong with that? She thought, as many wives of people who later come out as gay and lesbian can attest, that this was a phase. She thought at times that it was a sexual fetish. She thought at other times that it was just something that she would have to live with, but didn't take away from the other things that he had to offer. So she made a lot of excuses for it.
You first found out that your father thought of himself as a woman and cross-dressed when you were in your teenage years. It was your mother who told you. How did she break the news?
My mother broke the news after we went shopping for jeans in a mall near our Cleveland home. And what she did was she told me that my father liked to wear women's clothes. I was shocked, but I wasn't shocked so much by the fact that my father had this particular, I don't know what to call it, interest, as I was just that my father didn't really hate me. I sort of had this very typical child perspective that the reason my father didn't reach out to me was because it had something to do with me, not because it was something emanating from him. And so when my mother told me this, I steeled myself against it and said, okay, I'm not going to be interested in this. I'm not going to reach out to my father. I'm not going to react. And I burst into tears anyway. And the first thing that my mother recalls me saying was that, oh my God, so you mean he doesn't hate me?
6 months after your mother told you about your father left the family. Do you know why he left?
He left to figure out who he was. He left to start dressing. And this was not something that he could do while he was still in our house. It wasn't something I was prepared to see or to deal with yet. And it wasn't something that my mother certainly wanted to have going on at home, because she was having a lot of mixed emotions about my father's transition to a woman as well. So my dad got her own apartment, and she proceeded to sort of experiment with different sort of, you know, clothes and lifestyle options, basically.
During the period when your father knew that he identified as a woman, even though he was in a male body, how did his sense of being a woman compare to your sense of being a woman as you were coming into womanhood?
Well, that was actually a huge source of conflict between us for a while. When my father started living full-time as a woman, at first she became this sort of frightening Martha Stewart type of happy homemaker hybrid. It was really terrifying. She was compulsively arranging flowers and organizing guest soaps in the bathroom and buying everything in the shade of mauve. Everything was mauve for a while there. And this was at the very same time that I was getting into feminism and going on marches and cutting all my hair off and not wearing makeup and trying out veganism. And so we obviously were at odds. My father would sort of tell me about how thrilling it was to be able to vacuum, and that vacuuming was such a really wonderful thing that women got to do that men didn't get to do, which obviously is not quite the case. But and so we had a lot of arguments, and you know, what ended up actually happening was that my father, you know, did end up sort of mellowing into a much less sort of stereotypical woman. But then again, so did I.
If you're just joining us, my guest is writer Noelle Howie. Her new memoir, Dress Codes, is about three girlhoods, her mother's, her father's, and her own. Her father is a transsexual who had his surgery when Noelle was about 23. She found out that about his gender confusion when she was in her teens. You've decided to go with your father when he decided to have his sex change operation, which was in Brussels?
Yes.
Did you say goodbye to your father, the man, right before he had the surgery to become a woman?
I don't know if it was before the surgery, but it was while my father was in the hospital. I realized that the man who I had grown up with, who I had loved and who I had hated both, wasn't coming back. Even to this day, I still miss him. You know, I love her. I see her all the time. We live near each other now. But I do miss him. I will always miss him. There's something about somebody where you don't realize how much you love them based on your senses of them, what they smell like, what they look like, how their skin feels. You don't have any sense of that until it's gone, because most people don't have those things change entirely. My father's hormones changed, you know, her pheromones changed. Everything about the way that I experienced her as a physical presence changed. And that's not an experience most people go through with somebody who's still alive.
Is your mother still close with your father?
Yes, they're very good friends. Mm-hmm. They see each other from time to time, and we all share non-traditional Christmases together.
So, not to get too theoretical here or anything, but what are some of the conclusions you've reached about the nature of gender and how fixed gender is or isn't?
It seems to me that there's some sort of spectrum for gender. There's also the Kinsey scale for sexuality, which goes from 1 to 7, on one end being totally homosexual and the other end being totally heterosexual. And it's been posited at different times that we all sort of fall somewhere in the middle of that. And I think that gender is very much the same, that there is a spectrum from extremely feminine to extremely masculine. And most of us aren't on either pole. We're someplace in the middle. I think that in a lot of ways, being transgender is just, it's always been sort of discussed as this bizarre affliction that happens to about 1% of the population. And gender is not something that happens to 1% of the population. It happens to 100% of the population. This is something that we all deal with. And I think people are a little scared of people who are transgendered because it's familiar, not because it's so foreign. And this is something that I wanted to write about because it's not something that I had seen depicted, even in, you know, movies and TV shows, and whether, you know, Hedwig and the Angry Inch or Boys Don't Cry, or there's a lot of media out there about transgendered people, and a lot of it's really well done, but the people were always alien. They weren't people that, I guess, normal average Joes could relate to. And my father is not particularly exotic or strange at all.
Even though your father is now a she, do you still call her dad?
I do, and I do still call my father dad, and this is a somewhat controversial topic in the transgender community. Most people tend to switch. When somebody switches gender, they also switch whether they're a mother or a father. But my father and I have stuck with father because, well, the basic biological facts still remain that she is my father. You know, that's what she brought to the party originally. And I personally feel that being a man and being a father are not the same thing. My father is my father because she loves me, because she's a wonderful parent, because she's protective, because she's everything that a father should be, except that she doesn't have, you know, the appropriate genitalia, which I think we can all say is not a major part of a father-daughter relationship. So I can't say that that has particularly changed how I feel about her as a parent, and therefore it hasn't changed the words I use to describe her.
Well, Noel Howie, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Noel Howie is the author of the memoir Dress Codes. Coming up, Maureen Corrigan reviews the debut novel by Ann Packer. This is Fresh Air. Ann Packer has received numerous awards for her short stories, some of which have been gathered into a collection called Mendocino and Other Stories. She's just written her first novel, called The Dive from Clausen's Pier, and book critic Maureen Corrigan says Packer's novel, which edges toward 400 pages, is still too short. She wants more.
I was at a barbecue on Saturday night where the subject turned to books. The hostess, a friend, said that she felt more on top of her reading these days. There's not that much out there, she said. Once you have more of a sense of your own tastes, you can winnow out those books you know aren't going to appeal to you. Isn't it pretty to think so, I told her, demonstrating once again that the greatest social value of a PhD in English is the access it gives you to literary quotations for every occasion. Rather than feeling more on top of my reading, I'm feeling more daunted by the cosmic expanse of so many books, so little time. There are the classics, as well as all those highly acclaimed contemporary books I haven't gotten around to reading yet. There are all the beloved authors I want to reread, like every Dickens novel in sequence this time round. And mysteries? I've discovered Ian Rankin, and I have to restrict myself to one of his novels per month, otherwise nothing else would get done. To make matters worse, all these new writers keep on appearing. I just reviewed Jonathan Safran Foer's amazing first novel, Everything is Illuminated. This week, another superb and stylistically very different debut novel has me raving. It's called The Dive from Clausen's Pier by Ann Packer. There is no such thing as getting on top of reading. You read and read, you flail around and struggle to gain a foothold, and then, before you know it, another great book knocks you over. Because I don't have Ann Packer's gift for deceptively unadorned language that captures the complexities of a situation, the plot of The Dive from Clausen's Pier may sound contrived. With that caveat, here goes. A 23-year-old woman named Carrie Bell is feeling restless. She's lived all her life in Madison, Wisconsin, gone to college there, now works in the university library. Her circle of friends hasn't changed since high school. She's been with her boyfriend Mike since she was 14. Now they're engaged. On Memorial Day weekend, Mike, Carrie, and their friends drive out as usual to Clausen's Reservoir for a picnic. Because Mike senses Carrie's growing distance, he does something stupid to win her attention and affection. He dives off Clausen's Pier into the ice-cold reservoir. Except that it's been a very dry spring in the Midwest, and the reservoir is much lower than normal, and so Mike breaks his neck. He wakes from a coma many weeks later to find that he's now a quadriplegic. And Carrie, who was subconsciously planning to break up with him, finds that she's been fixed into the role of grieving but stalwart fiancé. Temporarily fixed, that is, because one night she gets into her car and impetuously drives to New York. As Carrie, our first-person narrator, races away from her martyrdom in Madison, she throws out this explanation in the form of a question to the reader. How much do we owe the people we love? How much do we owe them? What I had discovered was that I couldn't give up my life for Mike. That's how I saw it at the time. That's the choice I thought I had to make. And because I couldn't give up everything, I also thought I couldn't give up anything. It's standard with a novel like this to say the language rises above the flamboyant aspects of the plot. But Packer has an organic vision of her story here. Mike's accident is the melodrama of reality. When she arrives in New York, Carrie seeks out a gay friend from high school and moves into the second floor landing of the ramshackle brownstone he rents with about five other people. She pursues a relationship with a strangely aloof but seductive guy named Kilroy. Meanwhile, minor characters in Madison and New York claim their own erratic adventures, marriage, the loss of a parent, a catapult into literary fame. Even more than the ingeniousness of this sprawling plot, Packer's novel is distinguished by the psychological subtlety of her language, the way she hints at, rather than overstates, Carrie's semi-decisions. Carrie's passion is sewing, and pages here are devoted to engrossing descriptions of how she chooses fabric, cuts it into pieces, snips thread, pins a hem, superheats her iron, assembles an article of clothing from nothing. Packer might as well be describing her own slow, precise, and utterly compelling method as a writer. The shape of the storyline she puts together by the end of the dive from Clawson's Pier is like nothing you've seen or could have anticipated.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed The Dive from Clawson's Pier by Ann Packer. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Bob Purdick. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Sherrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Delta Trade Paperbacks, a division of Random House, publisher of Paradise Park by Allegra Goodman, author of Catterskill Falls. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, as President Bush heads for his first summit meeting in Russia, we talk with Strobe Talbott. His new memoir is about his work as the architect of the Clinton administration's Russia policy. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.